Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It is Monday, December 30th. More seismic activity is underway at Kilauea. We check in with the National Park Service on the latest for viewing for the new year. And this is the season for fresh fish on the menu for your holiday parties. We check in on the ahi prices at local fish markets. We take a look at coconut plantations across the Pacific, what satellites can tell us about their abundance and the threats they pose to native ecosystems. And around this time of year, many government workers opt to retire. We honohoa our interview with Honolulu's longest serving city employee. He was hired back in the 60s at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Mahalo to Howard Okumura for his public service. He told us he has no plans to retire soon. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been a week since Kilauea rumbled back in the headlines. The on-again, off-again eruption has delighted parkgoers. And as visitors make plans to visit the park over the next few days around the New Year's holiday, the National Park Service wants to make sure everyone stays safe. Scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey Hawaii Volcano Observatory are continuing to monitor seismic activity and what that might bring in the days to come. Jessica Furikane is with the National Park Service. We talked to her this morning about what to expect as people make their way to the park to see Kilauea's fireworks. January marks Volcano Awareness Month, and this latest eruptive phase is putting on an early show.
Kilauea is definitely very active currently right now, but we just don't know what this volcanic activity has in mind. We don't know if it's going to continue like this with this beautiful fountaining and feeding of the lava lake from the southern part of Halemaumau Crater, or if it's going to quit again and not stop for a while. We just don't know. What we do know is we are getting a lot of people visiting Hawaii Volcanoes National Park right now, and we have some great advice up on our website I would love to share with your listeners.
Yes. And, you know, obviously public safety is number one. And you did have that scare last week with a young child at the edge of the cliff there.
Yes. Some of our primary messaging is please keep your children close at all times. This national park, like many others, it's not a playground. The open overlooks, like such as Kilauea Overlook, are right near cliff edges that are 400 to 500 feet deep. So that would be a one-way tragic trip for somebody who ventured too close to the very unstable cliff edges that we have here. It's really important for visitors to stay out of closed areas, to stay on trails, and to stay at overlooks.
For folks who may not have heard the story, I mean, you saw someone in the Kapu area, right?
Yeah, I was helping, like a lot of us, we are wearing two hats right now. I was helping park cars at Kilauea Overlook, and we had a little bit of a lull, so I walked out to the overlook to take a peek at Pele, and I noticed out of the corner of my eye, this woman ducked under the post and cable barrier, just screaming, and I didn't know why. And I look over and I see this toddler just running headlong to the cliff edge. And he was maybe a foot or two away from, it makes my stomach turn just even thinking of it. And she was just screaming and grabbed him in the very nick of time. And it happened within seconds. So the whole family got really lucky. And that happened on Christmas night. So I can only imagine the other near misses that have happened in the park, you know, especially with people who are not keeping a close eye on their kids or going into closed areas. It can be a scary place.
Yes. And so we just need to remind everybody to be very watchful, you know, and mindful. You know, folks are probably on holiday and enjoying the sights. And like you said, it's a magnet for crowds.
It is. And we always urge people, I mean, this is our mantra with every eruption, is to plan ahead. Know what you're getting into. Realize that we have really crowded times right now in the park. The park's open 24 hours a day, and these overlooks are extremely crowded. So people want to get away from crowds, and so they're more tempted, I think, to, you know, cross over a barrier or whatnot. We advise people, come after 9 o'clock at night or come well before sunrise. You'll have a better experience. And if you do come during darkness, of course, bring a headlamp.
And because of the timing of this, you know, right around New Year's, where people, you know, like to see fireworks, and this is Mother Nature, you know, at its best.
Yeah, well, Pele is definitely making enough fireworks for everybody up here. Fireworks are prohibited in the park unless they're nature's fireworks. So if you are planning to come up to the park, please leave your fireworks and your drones behind.
Well, what can you tell us? Are you folks take extra precautions? You have extra staff on for the New Year's?
We have called in all the staff we can. We've brought in staff from other parks. And really what we're doing mostly is doing parking, because there is such a demand to come in between the hours of 5 to, say, 8 o'clock. So a lot of us are parking cars. Other rangers are patrolling to keep people safe. The visitor center still has its normal hours. So it's really all hands on deck right now. And with an eruption that could last well into the new year, it looks like this is going to be business as usual for a little while.
And then what can you tell us about air quality? Because I know the health department last week, you know, put out the advisory just for folks. I mean, here on Oahu, we've had some glorious sunsets thanks to the VOG. But right. Yeah, but what's the message out there?
Yeah, definitely check the air quality before you arrive and even during your visit. We have light winds this morning, which means that big plume, which has sulfur dioxide and carbon dioxide in it, is, you know, that's coming over, that has the possibility of blowing over overlooks in the park. And those gases are toxic, not just to everybody, but especially to people that have heart and respiratory issues and pregnant women and young children. So check the air quality before you get here. Check the wind. On the park website, we have a link that shows in real time what the air is doing. It looks like everything is in the green or safe levels right now, but we do have some very light winds out of the south.
I don't know about the forecast for, you know, rain and the winds picking up at all?
Well, the NOAA forecast that I'm looking at now looks pretty good. We have maybe a couple scattered or isolated showers this week, lightish winds, but mostly it looks like a decent trade wind or east-northeast wind pattern. That's what you want when you visit the park. You want all the areas, you want that plume being blown away. And as long as we have trade winds, the plume is being blown to the southwest. Not so great for our neighbors in Na'alehu, Pahala, Kona, and even Oahu, but definitely better for viewing safer in the park.
Anything else that you want to underscore as you get the crowds down there?
Watch out for Nene. It's the breeding season right now for our rare Hawaiian goose, our state bird. And right now they're encountered in parking lots. They're seen near roadways, et cetera. They are feeding. We have goslings in some areas of the park. So please drive cautiously. Never, ever feed Nene. Keep a distance away from them, at least 60 feet, which is about 4 car lengths.
Any idea on what kinds of crowds you might expect? I don't know what the capacity is over there at the park.
Yeah, well, luckily we're a 24-hour park, so people can come during these off hours and avoid the crowds. You know, the capacity is, you know, people start parking on the road or in unsafe, unwise areas. So that is always a concern. So that's why we're really urging people to come during these unconventional hours and take advantage of the park being open around the clock.
Okay. And people should check your website just for any updates.
Yes, that's a great place to start. If you come, you know, these eruptions are really powerful events. Pele Hunua Mea, she is the elemental volcanic force back to the home in Halema'uma'u Crater. So know that. Be awed when you come here. Try to listen. The sounds of the lava just gnashing within the lava lake, it's stupendous. If you can just be quiet for a little bit and listen to that sound, it'll definitely give chicken skin to you.
Wow. All right. Okay. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Okay, Catherine, thanks for the opportunity.
Yes, so listen to the volcano. We have been hearing from Jessica Farrakhan, Public Affairs Specialist with Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. You can check our website for links for safe viewing over the next few days. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Oni Ukahoolami, o Hawaii.
Because Kilauea began erupting last week, today's backyard quiz is all about the active volcano. Kilauea formed underwater 280,000 years ago with a surface area slightly smaller than the island of Oahu. You might picture a volcano as a single peak in caldera, but Kilauea actually has more than two dozen craters, most of which sit along its east rift zone. Along with Mount Etna in Sicily, it is one of the most active volcanoes in the world. 90% of Kilauea's surface is covered by new rock and lava flows from the last 1,000 years. In 2019, Kilauea's Halemaumau crater was temporarily filled with water, but a year later, lava re-entered the crater and boiled off the lake. During the year the pooling water existed, it ranged in color from bright blue to turquoise, yellow, brown, and red. For today's quiz, we want to know what caused the lake to turn these vibrant colors. Be specific. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
You know, Christmas has just blown by, but New Year's Eve and New Year's Day parties are almost upon us. And you know what that means? The hunt for fresh fish is on. HPR's Mark Liddell joins us this morning. Hi, how you doing?
Good morning, Catherine. And yeah, you're right. End of the year, so there's a huge demand for fish, as everybody knows is the case. You know, I talked to local fishers and stakeholders, and they said there's something about 100,000 pounds of fish being brought in every day by local commercial longliners. So there is a lot. Whether or not that's enough to meet the demand, I think it depends on who you ask. But there is a lot being sold and moved around in the islands right now. You know, a big part of that, you know, the demand is really high is through things like prices. You know, I was looking, you can check this online, but the Honolulu fish auction, where a lot of fish that's caught goes through and is sold, they have daily prices for some of their species. And, you know, the average, I have some from to this morning and Saturday and Friday, the last few times I did the auction. And today it was $4.50 on average for all fish, and over $6 for big eye, nearly $6 for all fish on Saturday, and same thing on Friday. And that's a good and high price for local fishers who sort of profit around the $4 or $5 range, although a lot of them recently have said that they do more on like the $2 or $3 range. So this is a good time for them. And so it's not unexpected to see prices kind of this high. And obviously you expect that because it's the sort of the end of the year and the New Year's Day celebrations. And most of that fish that's caught is ahi, so it's big eye, yellowfin tuna. And for retailers too, business is picking up. On Friday, while things were still kind of okay, I imagine today is probably pretty busy, but I talked to Guy Tamashiro, who's the vice president for Tamashiro Market in the Kalihi Palama area, and you know, he said that around today and tomorrow it's gonna be pretty busy.
Christmas is a lot more than a regular week, and New Year's maybe hopefully two to three times that. But our cost goes up quite a bit too, you know, in terms of the labor. Not my labor, even if I got to wake up 3 o'clock in the morning to go to auction. But everybody else is on overtime and things like that for the week, and we're just trying to keep up with the amount of work that needs to be done. I mean, there is so much work. It's just immense.
I didn't think about that. Yeah, overtime, right? Holiday.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I was talking to Guy and he said, you know, the only reason I'm able to talk to you is because I'm like getting caught up on paperwork. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to talk to you. So, yeah, it sounds really busy on the retail side, but also on the wholesaler side, the folks who are at the auction and probably like even the fishers, because it's right now is the time to make a lot of money. And, you know, when it comes to it being busy, it obviously tied into that is, you know, the prices of fish, and there's kind of a delicate balance between the folks who catch fish, the fishers, and those who buy the fish, and like the wholesalers and the retailers. Obviously, the fishers want a higher price as they can get, so the prices right now are really good. There's pros and cons for those who buy, because the more expensive the fish is, the more they have to mark it up for customers,
and that's right, you know, and me.
Yeah, right. People, you know, if it's more expensive, you might not want it. That is a tough thing. And just to kind of give a little idea of what the retailers are doing, I talked to Guy, and he had mentioned that he buys fish directly from the auction and not through a wholesaler. So the wholesaler doesn't get that middle person doesn't have to get a cut of the money. So Guy, he can buy fish at a bit of a higher price, and he doesn't have to sell it at like an even higher market price for customers. I talked to him again, and here's what he said.
I'm a retailer actually, but I'm buying fish right next to the wholesalers, and I think for us that's our competitive edge, because we're buying fish not dependent on what somebody else is going to give me. It's what I see and what we want to buy there, you know, what we think is of value. We are actually bidding on the floor for our fish, not getting it from a wholesaler, just doing our thing. If we can pay a little bit more, because we're not paying a wholesaler markup, and get the quality that we want.
Yeah, it's all about quality.
Yeah, right, especially right now, because so many people want sashimi. Although, you know, he said something interesting. I don't think it's particularly surprising, but he said that the highest quality fish gets sold out first, but so does like the cheapest fish.
Because
I think people just want fish mm-hmm. available. So, just people just want a ton of fish right now. Again, that's totally not surprising. I bring up all of this because and the prices again, because that's sort of been a big issue. And I've done some reporting on it, I think a couple months ago, on the fisher side. So I talked to a couple of local fishers who had mentioned that things like the prices at the fish auction have been relatively stagnant despite things like inflation over the last few years. And so it's harder for them to make money on the fish because, you know, inflation raises things like the prices of things like gas or like bait. And these fishing trips are a lot more expensive.
It cuts into their profit.
Yeah. And so in that previous reporting, I talked about sort of those issues and some of the solutions that some stakeholders and industry leaders have wanted to implement. One, we're probably going to see it during the upcoming legislative session. This is a labeling bill. And what that'll do essentially is it'll make retailers, so you know, stores that you might buy like a poke bowl from, to have a country of origin label, because I don't think you probably won't see that right now at stores. It might say it's fresh fish, but it won't tell you where that like poke is from. But I talked to Eric Kingma, who's the executive director of the Hawaii Longline Situation, and who's sort of leading the bill. And here's what he had to say about what's going to be inside the bill.
The proposed legislation would require retailers, so not restaurants or food service, just retailers, to extend the country of origin labeling requirements that they do now for, say, tuna steaks or fillets of mahi-mahi to raw ahi tuna. So yellowfin and big eye tuna. Raw ahi tuna products, which is essentially poke and sashimi, at the retail establishments only. And so consumers then would have information before them that would identify you know, not just if it was previously frozen and gassed or if it's fresh, which retailers are supposed to be doing now, but to have the origin. So it'd either be, you know, product of Vietnam, previously frozen, treated with carbon monoxide, or, for example, it would be product of the United States, fresh, ahi.
Yeah, all about the labeling.
Yeah, and we haven't been able to get into it too much today, but you know, imported fish is such a big deal in Hawaii. Obviously, you need it because most of the fish caught here commercially in Hawaii stays here and is consumed here, but we don't catch enough fish to meet the local demand, so obviously you need imported fish to meet the demand, but also it's cheaper.
Yeah.
You need cheaper fish.
Right, so, right. Yeah. You got to play with those price points, but yeah, I'm partial to fresh. So I'm all for laboring.
Right. And so the legislation, what it'll do is it's supposed to help people understand more what kind of fish they're buying. Is it imported? Is it fresh? Is it locally caught? Is it not? So
yeah,
we'll see that during the legislative session.
All right. Well, we'll look for your reporting. But thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been chatting with HVR's Mark Liddell all about the price of ahi this holiday season.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
The world takes you outside your borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble.
We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stay with you for a lifetime. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global news and inspiring voices that will keep you on top of the world.
Listen each weekday.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, with courses for ages 50 and older at UH Manoa, community colleges, and online beginning January 21st. More by searching OLLIUHM.
Consider the coconut. 1,000 years ago, Polynesian voyagers introduced this canoe plant to Hawaii and other islands in the Pacific. But how widespread is the coconut palm? Well, a new study uses satellite imagery to look at the presence of coconut plantations across hundreds of Pacific atolls, revealing their widespread impact on native vegetation. Michael Burnett is a doctoral student at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He led the research when he was working at the Nature Conservancy. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the findings.
When I was in college, I actually got to go do research on a Palmyra Atoll, which is an atoll that's jointly managed by the Nature Conservancy and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And that was kind of my first like entry into this world of Pacific Island conservation and science. And at Palmyra, they have huge amounts of coconut plantations all abandoned, and they're actually trying to start reverting those back into the native forests. And I thought that was really fascinating because in my mind, I'm like, well, coconut trees are just like a normal, you know, like typical part of these islands. But that's how I kind of got in touch with Alex Wegman, who's the senior author on this paper. And as an offshoot of that project, I ended up creating this map of where the coconuts are just on Palmyra. And I ended up publishing that. And then I later ended up working at the Nature Conservancy, and Alex Wegman got back in touch and said, here's a crazy idea. Can we do this for every atoll in the Pacific? And I naively said, oh yeah, it should be easy. It'd take me like a year or something. But using some really generous support from like private foundations, we were able to acquire like a huge amount of satellite imagery, which is just really fantastic data to do this kind of work. We were very methodical. We like made a list of every atoll. It's kind of hard to find information on some of them just because they're so remote. Many of them are uninhabited. But we acquired all that imagery and just really went through trying to be as detailed as possible to make these maps.
Yeah, and it tells such an interesting historical story, too, because just like you were saying, I think a lot of people take for granted that coconut palms have always been here. And so is there a way they could have gotten to, especially some of these more remote atolls, or does that tell a story about deliberate human action to plant coconut palms?
Yeah, really, it's very difficult for us to say because, you know, coconuts are, you know, native to much of the Pacific. They are able to float as coconuts and go to a whole new island thousands of miles away and propagate. So it's hard to really, like, draw boundaries on, like, where they were and where they weren't. Like, we were pretty sure that they weren't in Hawaii, for instance, but then, like, on Palmyra, which is 1,000 miles south, like, it's not really clear if that was introduced by Polynesian seafarers or if it managed to float there. But what I think we do have pretty good evidence for in this paper, and just from looking at historical documents, is that in places where coconuts were just either naturally floating to or just used as like a subsistence crop, they comprised a relatively small amount of the total vegetation on the island. Like naturally, they probably grow right on the shoreline where the coconuts wash up, and then they grow like outward over the water. But what you really see in the last 200 years as Europeans would come into these islands is they would cut and burn a whole island's forest, and then plant just grids of coconut in order to produce coconut oil, or copras. We actually do this really interesting analysis in the paper where we look at atolls where we do know that there was some like industrial coconut production at some point, and atolls that we know never had that. And we can see that the atolls that do have some history of that, even if it was 100 years ago and it stopped a long time ago, on average, they were 32 percentage points higher in their coconut cover than those islands that never had it. So it's clearly this strong, persistent effect of plantation agriculture on the composition of these forests.
For instance, what does that mean for some of the native or endemic biodiversity on some of these atolls?
Yeah, there's really profound effects on these ecosystems. And I think in the last 20 years, there's been a lot of amazing scholarship that's kind of illuminated that. I think probably the biggest factor is that those broadleaf trees that originally would have been dominant on these atolls, they provide great nesting habitat for seabirds. And so you have these seabirds that fly, you know, hundreds of miles sometimes away from these islands. They're foraging for fish and other marine resources. They're coming back to that island and essentially they're pooping all over it. And these islands are naturally pretty infertile. They're made out of calcium carbonate. So those seabirds and their guano is really a critical vector for nutrients to come back to the island. So if you get rid of all of those broadleaf trees and you just have coconut palms, which are obviously just like a single horizontal trunk and not that much horizontal space, you're losing a lot of area for those seabirds to be returning nutrients to the island. And there's been papers out of Palmyra Atoll from the Nature Conservancy, as well as a variety of others that show you have fewer seabirds, the soil is much less fertile once you make that transition to coconut agriculture. And we also have some new evidence coming out of Palmyra that it has negative impacts on land crab populations, which are actually like the dominant terrestrial animal on many of these islands.
When you think about a monoculture, essentially, is what you're describing, what are the potential impacts were something to invade and damage the predominant tree on any given atoll?
It could cause a really profound like state shift in that ecosystem if, yeah, your forest is 90% coconut and then those all die at roughly the same time. Yeah, that can have huge impacts. And that's something that I think it's spreading across these tiny Pacific islands. And it's unfortunate because while a lot of these coconut plantations have been long abandoned and may not be providing economic value, there are still a lot of islands that do rely on them either for subsistence or for economic output. And so if the coconut is so widespread and growing in monodominance on all of these islands, I would worry that that's just going to accelerate the spread to islands that do really rely on this plant for their well-being.
I know this study provides a baseline from which then you can figure out ways and interventions, but like, what is there to do?
I think that this study actually highlights maybe kind of an exciting like opportunity for a win-win here, because you have so many instances where, like, just globally, you have so many environmental problems where you have this dilemma of like, well, we need the economic output and it's at odds with, you know, our conservation goals. But here, many of these plantations are really, they're old palms, they're not productive, it's economically unfeasible, they're just there. And so if there's any local community who wants to decide, say if they want more seabird habitat, maybe they have some collaboration with like a larger conservation organization or a national government that's saying, we want to have more of these conservation areas. Maybe they would be able to try to convert some of that coconut palm back to native broadleaf forest. And that could have really beneficial ecosystem impacts. And I also want to highlight that a growing body of research is investigating the water impacts of these plantations. And so coconut palms can use a lot of water, and water is really scarce on a lot of these islands. Some of these populated atolls in the Pacific, if they have a drought, they rely on rainwater. And when it doesn't rain, they start pumping from wells to drink that water. And it's really easy to deplete the groundwater systems on these atolls. And so there might be some communities trying to chart their path through the future of rising sea levels and prolonged droughts. And they might say, we should really try to eliminate some of these coconut palms and plant trees that use less water and have more ecological benefits. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I think that there are, you know, like different scales of actors who might be able to use these maps to figure out how to manage these islands for their own purposes. And we really want to try to empower these communities to, you know, prioritize groundwater or prioritize ecological habitat or conservation. And that's a big part of the reason why we made these maps freely available. Anybody can go access it and try to, you know, weigh these different priorities. But I think there are places where this could be a great opportunity, both for conservation and for sustainability in the future.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that like shifting the decision-making power back to local communities.
Absolutely. And I think there's also, you know, that brings up this great point of like what people living on these islands know, and then what like the broader world knows. Because, I mean, frankly, people who live on these islands, like they know this stuff. They know about coconut palms very deeply, like at a level that I will probably never be able to comprehend. But I think that this is a really important study to kind of call attention to this from a broader audience and say, you know, this is a situation kind of similar to oil palm in Southeast Asia, but it's gotten very little wider press attention. And maybe that will help bring in resources from, say, like larger NGOs or foundations that are looking to do this conservation work. And maybe that could enable more resources to flow to these communities who want to make these management actions. I think we're entering this really exciting time where the amount of satellite imagery is just exploding. You know, this paper resulted from kind of like a first of its kind database, but the amount of data is really just staggering. And with continually improving AI and machine learning tools, I think it's entirely feasible that we could get annual monitoring or every 5 years monitoring well into the future to try to track this problem.
That was researcher Michael Burnett talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. His team's study was published earlier this month in the journal Environmental Research Letters. We'll have a link to it on the conversation page of our website after the show.
In his epic composition, The Lightbringer, Hawaii Symphony composer in residence Michael Thomas Fumai portrays an epic battle between good and evil. Tell me, what was the genesis of this piece, The Lightbringer?
Well, this is a piece that really starts with the title, The Lightbringer, and it has to do with the devil, an unsavory figure in Christianity. And it is something I was always very interested in because I was brought up Catholic and read Revelations and, you know, was kind of trying to picture the genesis of what would become the devil. And so I wanted to write music that really foretold this battle of the angels that we see in that chapter of the Bible. And that's what The Lightbringer is.
Stand firmly on the side of good by supporting 24 hours of classical music each and every day on HPR2. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org to donate.
The annual Christmas bird count, organized by the National Audubon Society, is the nation's longest-running community science bird project. And for the past month, communities in Hawaii and the Pacific Islands have looked to the skies to tally up our birds. The northwestern Hawaiian Islands turned in record high counts for seabirds this year, including more than 300 of the bird featured in today's Manu Minute. The bird is often seen but not heard. The great frigate, or Eva, flies high above our heads, performing acrobatic feats midair. But we've got the song of this storied seabird today, thanks to the Makaule Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo's Patrick Hart with your Manu Minute.
One of the most distinctive birds in the skies above Hawaii is the Eva, or Great Frigate Bird. Dark black and a bit ominous looking, they have a distinctive bent wing silhouette when in flight, with long pointed wings, a long hooked bill, and a deeply forked tail. Eva are found in oceans throughout the tropics, and while they're often seen on all the main Hawaiian islands, they nest primarily in shrubs and small trees in the northwest Hawaiian islands. Eva are incredibly agile flyers, and they use this maneuverability to harass other seabirds in flight and force them to drop their food, which they'll often grab in mid-air. The biological term for this pirate-like behavior is kleptoparasitism, and this has led to their Hawaiian name of Eva, which means thief. Though they actually do catch the majority of their food themselves by skimming the ocean surface for fish and squid. Eva have the largest wings for their body weight of any bird in the world, and recent studies using satellite transmitters have shown that they can fly over 2 months without landing. While they're incredible flyers, they lack the ability to take off from water, and they're also very clumsy on land. Eva are one of those birds that are much more often seen than heard. The best place to hear their vocalizations are on their breeding grounds, where the males attempt to attract females by blowing up a brilliant orange balloon-like pouch below their bills and uttering a hoarse cackle when the female comes near. Unlike many other native bird species in Hawaii, the Eva seem to be doing well, with a population size estimated at 60,000 birds or more. Eva have a lifespan of about 35 years, and like many seabirds, wait a long time before they first breed, in their case, 9 years or older. Eva are featured prominently in Hawaiian culture, and their glossy black feathers were used in the kahili of royalty and in feathered capes. One well-known Olelo Noeau proclaims, "Lele ka Eva malie kai ko'o," meaning, when the Eva bird flies out to sea, the rough sea will be calm. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, exploring Hawaii Island with visitors and kama'aina for more than 30 years. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
Now it's time to erupt the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the history and geography of Kilauea, the youngest and most active volcano on Hawaii Island. The most recent eruption began a week ago and is currently paused, though the National Park Service says the activity of the volcano could change at any time, impacting air quality in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park and visitor health and safety. We asked you about a lake inside the Halemaumau crater. That pond of water could be seen between August 2019 and September 2020. And it was 160 feet deep at one point, nearly the height of a 10-story building. But you wouldn't want to swim in this lake. Its water could be as hot as 185 degrees Fahrenheit. And it ranged in color from bright blue to turquoise to yellow and reddish brown. We wanted to know what caused the Kilauea Summit Crater Lake to display such vibrant colors. It was a result of iron sulfate minerals and the sulfur dioxide dissolving into the water from the volcano. Congrats to our winner today, Legea from Kaneohe. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
HPR Generation Listen invites you to Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. It's an opportunity to connect with fellow public radio nerds in an evening of lively but friendly competition. Gen Listen connects younger listeners and young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Connect with us in person at HPR Gen Listen Trivia. Sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Listen, baby, ain't no mountain high, ain't no valley low, ain't no river wide enough, baby.
If you need me, call me, no matter where you are, no matter how far.
Don't worry, baby.
The Division of Motor Vehicles recently rolled out a project that lets Hawaii residents take the written test for a driver's license and learner's permit online at any time. It's in response to an anticipated increase in DMV appointments since more than 100,000 licenses will expire in 2025. The program is meant to reduce wait times. And that jogged our memory. We wanted to look back on one of our favorite DMV segments about the longest serving city worker, Howard Okamura. 60 years ago, Okamura graduated from Farrington High School, and he applied for a job at the DMV. The pay was less than $3 an hour, which he thought was a lot of money at the time. Well, he got the job and is still there. Back then, the Honolulu mayor was Neil Blaisdell. And back in October, we got the chance to interview Okamura at the Kapalama DMV about his decades of service. He turned 80 this year, and he chuckles that even he can't believe he stayed as long as he did.
And I was thinking, maybe 35 years. But when 35 years came around, no, I didn't go. 40 years came around, I still was there. 50 years came around, I still there. And look what happened now. It's 60 years. Time flies. When I first started, it was mostly we type our own document and punch card at the same time, which was, IBM cards. Now it's all computerization. So that's a big change right there already. And now they're trying to put it online so that way you don't have files and all that. The only part is that kind of stuff. If the power goes down, how are you going to get to the files?
And so you were down at the DMV, when it was...
When it was at the old police station on Burton Street.
Pawa.
Right.
Pawa.
The old Sears.
Yeah. The old Sears building. And that time it wasn't, the registration wasn't staggered. It was January to December. then there was a grace period from January to March to renew it. If not, after that, it's penalty. And March 31st, we had the last 25,000, mind you, 25,000 didn't register their car yet. And the line on that day, oh, we had lines all zigzagging in the parking lot, and we had to straighten out the line. One line was on Young Street, and the other line went on Britannia, and the two line met at Keomoku. Can you imagine how many people that is? And we had to have people going through the line and checking the line and cut the line when maybe about 3:30, so that, you know, we can close it at least by decent time, which we close at 4:30, but then most time we had to close maybe about 5 something.
Not a very efficient way to do business.
And we used to, we had to balance that night and be ready to man the counter the next morning. And one time, March 31st was on a Sunday, and the head of our office told our office, can you come Sunday? So we were thinking about it, and we told them, okay, we come in. And then we came in, we lucky we had 100 on that day. When came Monday, the line was just like any March 31st, was horrendous.
Well, I'm sure this work is, like you say, it's endless, right? It's tedious, yeah. But it's got to be done. It's the kind of thing, if you're a upstanding citizen, you do the right thing and you register your car, you know, when it expires.
To me, they shouldn't have made staggered. They should have maybe moved the expiration to another month, because December 31st and then January to March, that's tax time. Some people don't have money to do registration. You tell them, oh, pinch next time, you know, and all that. They should have just moved the deadline and maybe increased the penalty. To have the same manpower 30 years ago, and you know, motor vehicle registration and increase from 30 years ago to now, over time, they gotta appropriate more money for overtime.
Yeah, because if you aren't increasing your staff, yeah, and your workload is whatever, quadrupled,
yeah,
you know?
And then now they're only holding 20,000. 20,000 will not take care of the backlog and all that. We had backlog, mind you, these past 2 weeks, we had backlog of maybe 10 trays. The trays were about 3 feet long. 10 of them, they didn't have money for pay overtime. You know, something is wrong there, you know.
We've been hearing from Howard Okumura, the city's longest-serving worker. His co-workers affectionately call him Uncle. Okumura says his co-workers at the DMV keep him young, and among his favorite memories are the Pauhana gatherings. He spoke highly of a DMV long-serving boss, Dennis Kamimura, who says he used to take the Hawaii Revised Statutes home with him to study. Okumura says Kamimura knew his stuff and was always receptive to new ideas about how to try and do things better.
His mind was always open, Dennis' mind was always open to new suggestion and whatever. The registration, when we saw some states, they had it barcoded. So when I told him, oh, we should do that barcoding. And when he said barcoding, I said, yeah. Some of the states, they had it barcoded on the document. He said, oh, that's a good idea. So he was open for how to do work.
What is it that you love about this job? I mean, you stuck around for a long time. A lot of people would have, you know, moved around, maybe go to work for the state, go to work for private sector. What is it about public service that made you stay?
Well, as far as the work at our office, I know it's backwards and forward already by now. It doesn't bother me, you know. I just do whatever they tell me, and they don't have to tell me how to do it because I know how to do it already. Yeah, I just buy the time away and just do my work, whatever is assigned.
And then what was it like during COVID? Because the work still had to get done.
Yeah. Well, they had to space our desks and then put the walls in between the desks. They could hardly do anything because they move us in this building here. When we were at the other side on Gateway, it was a bigger building. when they move us here, we had to rent offices next door, which you're paying outside now. Before, everything was with the city.
So as far as the work that you do, so you deal with customers on the phone, you process the registrations, you know, behind the scenes, on the back of the house, right? You've done both.
So a lot of time, you gotta get the information from the individual, just like pulling a teeth. You gotta get it from them before you can tell them exactly what is required.
Anything you don't like to do at this job?
The mail, because it's a lot of rejects. A lot of the document that they mail in, they mail it in any old way, you know? And then you gotta kind of piece it out, and a lot of other state company like that, they assume that they know, but then they don't know. So we gotta kind of educate them. And if they don't give us phone numbers, we got no choice but to send it back to them and tell them this and that and whatever. And if they have any question, to call us up and we give them the phone number. Before, when we moved into this building, it was strictly for handicapped. They open it up for regular people. So now when the handicapped wanna use, they say it's all full. That's not right, you know, because the federal law says you gotta provide for the handicapped.
So you think we can do better?
Yes.
Anything else you wanna share with us?
No, I guess it's just dealing with the public. You know, it's very challenging. It's not the same every day. Some days it's different from the other days, you know?
You think people are more rude these days?
Depend on how you take it, huh? They grumble to you and whatever. So I put them in place. I tell them, why are you taking it out on me? What did I do to you? You know, then they kind of calm down and whatever.
They just need a vent. But yeah, sometimes they can be inconsiderate and not so nice to city workers.
They say, oh, things weren't coming their way. I said, that happens to everybody, not only you. You know.
So yeah, if you're having a terrible, no good, very bad day, don't take it out on the city employees.
Yeah, so whether city employees or anybody, you gotta change your attitude. It's not me, me, me. You take care of other person, they take care of you.
There you go. That was our conversation with Howard Okamura. He was the city's longest serving employee. We caught up with him in October, right after Mayor Rick Blangiardi honored him as a thank you for his public service. Okamura's office surprised him with a party on his anniversary date. To throw him off, they told him it was a coworker's birthday and assigned him his specialty potluck dish. Potato mac salad, but made with spaghetti. Okamura was hired under Mayor Neil Blaisdell in October of 1964. And he says he has no real plans to retire from the DMV. His supervisor is also in her 80s, too. Okamura still drives his trusty Toyota Corolla to work every day and doesn't plan on getting on rail. His one pet peeve is that employees in the department who register the vehicles for the general public still have to stand in line like everyone else to get their paperwork done. No special treatment.
There she was, just walking down the street singing.
Well, that's it for us today. Tomorrow, we reflect on conversations that we've had with newsmakers of the past year and stories on the culture and art scene that are worth noting. Glad to say goodbye to 2024. What are your hopes for 2025? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation. Just as natural as can be, singing.